So my goal is to try to, in a half an hour, sort of summarize what we know about galactic winds locally and how we think we know it. And I think Crystal's probably going to be talking about the latest and greatest, you know, new exciting results. So hopefully our two talks will be complementary. This is just sort of an outline, and we'll see how far I get. I wanted to just sort of give you an introduction to the physics that we think is going on and try to summarize, probably for the most important for this meeting, is how do we think we estimate outflow rates of metals, energy, mass, and then something about the long-term fate of winds, how far they get out. So let me just briefly talk about the physics. Oops. So this is just a simulation from Strickland and Stevens of a few years ago. And if you like, you can think of this as basically kind of a cartoon, but it illustrates some important points that I want to make, and that is, so one message to take away from my talk is that galactic winds are multi-phase phenomena, and if you want to talk about what goes where and what gets out and in what form, you have to keep close tabs on the phases. So in a nutshell, the basic idea in a starburst is that the supernova rate per unit volume is hundreds or thousands of times larger than it is in the disk of a normal galaxy like the Milky Way, and empirically that seems to result in a very high efficiency for thermalization of the kinetic energy returned to the interstellar medium by supernovae and stellar winds. This takes place in a disk. This hot thermalized gas in the core of the starburst is going to expand most rapidly along the steepest pressure gradient and blow out along the minor axis of the galaxy out into the galactic halo, and it's going to carry a lot of fragments along with it. And in this picture, the color coding here is in density, from densities of log density of 10 to the minus 3 to 1. The bubble is roughly isobaric, so the temperature is sort of the inverse of the density. So there's a very hot cavity filled with the hot gas that contains a lot of the energy in the flow, blowing a bubble into the galactic halo and carrying with it a lot of fragments convected out, carried with the wind out of the disk. And these are just some close-ups of some of the little pieces of debris being blown into the halo. So when we observe galactic winds, we're going to see both the hot gas, which is traced most directly by X-rays, and then in optical line emission and in interstellar absorption lines, we'll be able to trace these denser fragments which are being propelled out into the halo. So that's the simple dynamical picture. Now let's actually talk a little bit about what we might expect to see. And these are just sort of order of magnitude estimates based on the simplest concept of a galactic wind. So let's imagine that we return energy to the interstellar medium in the form of supernova explosions at a rate E dot, and associated with that is a return of stellar mass ejecta at a rate of M dot. And what we actually see is going to depend on two parameters. One is what we could call the mass loading term, which is the ratio of the actual mass carried out in the flow divided by the mass returned from supernovae. So by definition, this would be 1 if there was no mixing at all in the interstellar medium in the galaxy and we were seeing the raw supernova ejecta. Epsilon is just the ratio of the kinetic energy in the wind compared to the rate of energy supplied by the supernovae. So by definition, it's less than or equal to 1. Now, what are the sort of natural scales of the problem? The natural temperature for the hot gas is going to be of order 10 to the 8 degrees if you had epsilon and lambda both unity. This is just taking E dot and M dot from supernovae, so it's very hot gas. On the other hand, as we'll see throughout the talk, lambda is probably pretty large, and in fact, we don't actually see any emission from gas this hot in galactic winds. Another important constraint on what's going on is the metallicity of the hot gas. If the gas, again, if the mass loading term were 1, so we were seeing pure supernova ejecta, then the alpha element abundances would be extremely high, of order, say, 10 times solar, and the alpha to iron ratio in the ejecta would be extremely large as well. This is just the formula that gives for a simple prescription of mixing. What you would expect to see is the actual metallicity of the alpha elements and the alpha to iron ratios as a function of this mass loading parameter, lambda. As we'll see a little bit later, there are some independent lines of evidence that suggest lambda is of order unit, is of order 10, and that gives us metallicities in the interstellar medium, the alpha elements of a few times solar, and alpha to iron ratios of several times solar as well, which is in agreement with the observations, as we'll see a little bit later. Another characteristic property of the wind is the Ram pressure in the flow. And the ram pressure is just going to be, obviously, m dot v divided by r squared omega wind, where omega is the solid angle of the flow. And you can put in some characteristic numbers for the typical starburst that I'm going to be talking about. The typical momentum flux in the wind would be of order 10 to the 35 dynes per second, or dynes, actually, I guess. And p over k, plugging in here, is of order 10 to the 7 k per cubic centimeter at a radius of a kiloparsec. And then if it were a mass-conserving flow, the pressure would drop like 1 over r squared. And I'll show you some data later where we can actually try to measure these pressure profiles in the wind. Crystal, I think, will probably talk about the possible importance of radiation pressure for a starburst that sort of magically works out, or for any population of massive stars, that the ratio of the ram pressure, assuming that this all works as planned up here, to the radiation pressure is of order unity, depends on how much mass loading there is, how much energy loss there is from radiation in the wind, depends on the solid angle of the wind, and so on. But from first principles, it seems like radiation pressure acting on dust grains in the flow could be comparable in dynamical importance to the ram pressure in the wind. During very early stages, this is behaving much like a wind-blown bubble, classic calculation done about 30 years ago. And the typical velocities, if you plug in the parameters appropriate for a starburst and the interstellar medium, would be a super bubble in the early dynamical evolution with an expansion velocity of a few hundred kilometers per second. Once the wind blows out into the halo, this high temperature up here gives us a natural flow speed for the hot wind, which, if there were no mass loading and no radiative losses, would be extremely high, of order 3,000 kilometers per second. We'll see that we don't actually infer such high velocities in the wind, consistent with certainly considerable amount of mass loading, and I'll talk about epsilon as I go along. Finally, in the cartoon I showed you, we saw that there were these cloud fragments which were embedded in the wind, and those will be accelerated to velocities of hundreds of kilometers per second. But I want to point out something which I hope to return to later in the talk, and that is that there are different dependences of the velocities of these fragments on the physical parameters for the fragments compared to the natural wind velocity. The wind velocity is set purely by whatever the microphysics is in the starburst that determines the mass loading and the amount of radiative energy losses in the hot fluid, whereas the terminal velocity that the clouds will reach depends on absolute quantities like the momentum flux in the wind, the distance where the cloud is launched from, the cloud column density, and so on. And I think this will be very important in understanding some of the results that I'll show later, and I think Crystal's probably going to talk about as well. Okay, so let's then go from sort of our expectations to what the observational consequences are. As I said, we know observationally that these are multi-phase flows in which the X-ray emission appears to trace some strong hydrodynamical interaction between this hot fluid, which is flowing out of the starburst, and ambient material in the disk or the halo. And that can be seen most clearly, I think, by the extremely strong morphological resemblance between H-alpha images of galactic winds and X-ray images. So here's a central region of the base of the wind in M82. This is a H-alpha image over here. This is a soft X-ray image over here. Basically, we've found in proposing for Chandra observations that the best way to simulate what the Chandra image will look like is to take the H-alpha image and just convolve it and put in the appropriate photon statistics, and you'll get something that looks awfully like what the real data eventually turn out to look like. So there's one example of the morphological relationship between the warm gas and the hot gas. Here's another example. This is the base of the galactic wind in NGC 3079. Here are the filaments in H-alpha being propelled out at about 1,000 kilometers per second from the starburst. This is the soft X-ray image. And just to convince you, one more example. This is the halo emission in the nearby starburst galaxy NGC 253. So we're now talking about structures on the order of 10 kiloparsecs. This is a H-alpha image. This is the star-forming disk of the galaxy. This is the X-ray image, and you can see these X-ray filaments protruding about 10 kiloparsecs into the halo of the galaxy. And again, the match between the X-ray and H-alpha morphologies is very good. So what do we think that means? We think that the most simple interpretation of this is perhaps that we're seeing the optical line emission coming from shocked interstellar medium material, and the X-ray emission is coming from the impact of the hot wind, perhaps a reverse shock in the hot fluid flowing out, which causes the adiabatically cooled wind fluid to light up in the vicinity of these targets where the H-alpha emission lines arise. Now, one other clue to what's going on is that we can try to determine the chemical composition of the wind. It's difficult to get absolute abundances with the data that are available so far, but we think we can measure the relative abundances of the alpha elements to iron fairly accurately. And here's a grading spectrum of NGC 253's wind, which I showed you a picture of just a few minutes ago. And you can see there are iron lines, there's oxygen, magnesium, neon, and so on. And in all the cases that have been looked at so far, the alpha to iron ratio in the galactic wind is in the range of several times solar, say 2 to 5 times solar. So this, if it were taken at face value, would imply that we're seeing some mixture of nucleosynthetic products from the starburst mixed in, heavily diluted with mass-loaded gas from the interstellar medium, which has a normal alpha to iron ratio. So both the X-ray emission that we see and the chemical abundances give us a sort of consistent picture of what this mass loading term might be, namely of order 10. Of order 10 slows the wind velocity down from 3,000 kilometers per second to the cube root of 10 of that, so 600 to 800 kilometers per second, which is then consistent with the shock speeds responsible for producing the X-ray emission, which is typically, say, 6 to 10 million degrees. So if we interpret the X-ray emission as shocks in the wind, we derive flow speeds, and these in turn imply mass loading terms of order 10. This is consistent with what you would deduce from the alpha to iron ratio from the sort of dilution picture where you take the heavily alpha-enriched ejecta from the type 2 supernovae and mix it with ambient interstellar gas. We also, I think, of particular interest, so we have the advantage over the stuff that Chuck talked about, that locally we can observe these winds in X-rays, we can look at optical line emission, but one of the most instructive ways to look at them, as is the case in high redshift, is to look at the interstellar absorption lines. And we see qualitatively and maybe even quantitatively flows that strongly resemble what Chuck sees at high redshift. So Crystal's going to talk quite a bit about the sodium D doublet, which has the advantage of being in the optical at low redshift, so we can get lots of good data. This is a nice slide because it shows what the interstellar sodium D doublet looks like through the disk of a normal galaxy. So this is the sodium D from the Milky Way, and this is the interstellar sodium D doublet seen towards the central regions of this luminous infrared galaxy. The systemic velocity of the doublet would correspond to here. So we're seeing gas extending from the systemic velocity of the galaxy up to a maximum blue shift of about 600 kilometers per second. And that's seen in neutral gas with fuse and with HST, especially with fuse. Now we can probe the kinematics of very highly ionized gas. And here's just an example of the oxygen 6 absorption line seen towards the center of the starburst galaxy NGC 3310. And the kinematics look similar to what I showed you for the sodium D line, which is tracing the neutral gas in this other galaxy. Namely, you see blue shifted absorption extending from close to systemic velocity up to a maximum velocity of about 700 kilometers per second. And the interpretation of this, of these profiles, which seem to be characteristic both of the Lyman break galaxies and the local starburst, is that we are seeing material which starts at the systemic velocity and then is accelerated by the wind or possibly radiation pressure up to some very high terminal velocity. And so if you interpret it that way, you would say this is kind of the point at which the clouds are maybe moving along with the fluid in the hot wind. And that would be consistent with what I inferred from the X-rays, namely shock speeds of 500 to 800 kilometers per second. Those velocities you see in the X-ray gas in systems like this agree pretty well with the most blue-shifted gas that you see in the interstellar absorption lines. So one thing that's very exciting, and I think is a pretty new result, is that there's a lot of dust in these flows as well. Now, we kind of had some indirect evidence of that from the sodium D analysis that we did several years ago, but it was a kind of an indirect argument. Here's a direct evidence of dust in the flow. This is an image taken with Galax in blue. So blue shows the far UV continuum, and the red shows the H-alpha filaments in M82. And the UV and the H-alpha filaments trace one another almost perfectly. The UV continuum is much too bright to be nebular emission from this shocked gas. And the most natural interpretation, which is actually consistent with data from eons ago about polarimetry of the halo of M82, is that we're seeing scattering off of dust grains in the halo of M82. So not only are these galactic winds expelling hot gas that we see in X-rays and these cool fragments that we see in the interstellar absorption lines, but dust is being carried out into the halo as well. So these are truly multi-phase flows. I won't really have time to talk about it, but in some well-studied cases, you can see relativistic plasma, which is probably being advected in the hot wind and carried out into the halo of the galaxy as well. How much dust? Well, so the indirect estimates would be if the dust-to-gas ratio is similar to solar in the Milky Way value, then you're getting something like 1% of the mass flux. So the mass flux is, you know, 5 or 6 solar masses a year, so 1% of that would be in the form of dust grains. Okay, so let me then, having given you kind of an introduction to what we see when we look at these flows, say just a couple of words about demographics, and I want to kind of rush through this because I realize I'm going to run out of time. Suffice it to say that you can look at, people have done large surveys using the H-alpha emission line to image edge-on starburst galaxies, and this is the most famous example, M82, but you can look at the incidence rate of these filaments of warm photoionized or shock-heated gas extending along the minor axes of galaxies as a function of their star formation rate per unit area. And what's found is that there seems to be a threshold in the star formation rate per unit area somewhere in the range of 1 to 0.1 solar masses per year per square kiloparsec where these things turn on and you see them. And what's interesting about that is, this is from a paper by Kennicott that was looking at the Schmidt law for star-forming galaxies. The main point I want to make here is that the symbols here are, the solid dots are disks of normal galaxies which have star formation rates of 10 to the minus 2 to 10 to the minus 3 solar masses per year per square kiloparsec. The solid squares are starbursts. So starbursts sort of turn on around 10 to the minus 1 solar masses per year per square kiloparsec, and that's just the point where we start to see these minor axis filaments appearing commonly in edge-on galaxies. And this may be related perhaps to this concept of effective thermalization of the supernova energy when the star formation rate per unit area is high. Now, we've just completed, we're about to submit a paper where we have looked at a X-ray survey of the nearest 22 starbursts selected in a special way. We've picked, basically there's about 7 or 8 of each of these kinds. We've picked the nearest starbursting dwarf galaxies, the nearest edge-on L-star type starburst galaxies, edge-on so that we can see the flow in the halo clearly without being confused by disk emission, and then the nearest brightest ultra-luminous infrared galaxies. And what we find is that there are remarkably simple scaling relations between the X-ray properties of these different classes. And one way to see that, maybe a picture is worth a thousand words. These are Chandra X-ray images color-coded in the same way, so the surface brightness means the same thing and the color means the same thing in terms of X-ray temperature. This is a dwarf galaxy where we're looking at X-ray emission with a scale of about 1 kiloparsec. This is an edge-on L-star galaxy driving a wind where we're now looking at 15 kiloparsecs from top to bottom. And here's an ultra-luminous galaxy where we're looking at now 75 kiloparsecs from top to bottom. These are showing the relative size of the different boxes, so this thing would fit in this little box here in the center. So they look very self-similar. The X-ray emission just gets bigger and bigger as you look at galaxies having higher and higher star formation rates. And let me just try quantifying that a little bit. So this is the ratio of the thermal X-ray emission. So we've weeded out anything from the AGN or point sources that are X-ray binaries. We're looking at the diffuse thermal emission. This is the ratio of the thermal emission in X-rays to the far infrared luminosity, which is we're taking as a proxy for the star formation rate. And this ratio is typically 10 to the minus 4, so the X-ray luminosity is down by 10 to the 4 from the bolometric luminosity of the starburst. There's a fair amount of scatter, but what you can see is that over nearly 4 orders of magnitude in star formation rate, the ratio shows no sign of changing. So the ultra-luminous galaxies have proportionally more soft X-ray emission from these outflows than the dwarf galaxies. You can also look at the surface brightness. So we just picked the radius, which encloses 90% of the diffuse X-ray emission, and then calculated the mean surface brightness inside the 90% radius. And again, you see the surface brightnesses of these X-ray nebulae are the same, again, over about four orders of magnitude in star formation rate. So they're just bigger versions. The things in the Eulers are just big versions of what you see in the dwarf galaxies. Yeah, hold on a sec. Let me go back. Over here? The stars are the, I believe the stars are the Eulers, which an optical spectroscopist would say contain an AGN. And the triangles are the ones classified optically as non-AGN. So
there isn't much difference.
No, there isn't much difference. This is NGC 6240 up here, which is the sort of poster child for the spectacular hidden AGN. We can also look at the temperature. Oops, that's the wrong. We can look at the temperature of these X-ray nebulae as a function of, this is now the X-ray luminosity, so the color coding, these are the dwarf galaxies, the L-star spirals, and the Eulers. And typically, for the diffuse extended emission, the temperatures are around a half a kilovolt in all three classes. So that's kind of interesting. I don't have a plot that shows it, but we see the same enhanced alpha to iron ratios in all three classes of objects. And the same morphological correspondence between the X-ray and H-alpha plasma that we see in the examples I showed you previously are also seen in the dwarfs and Eulers. So this is something maybe Crystal will talk more about. I'm not sure, but this is her Chandra H-alpha overlay of the nearby dwarf galaxy, NGC 1569, with the Chandra here in green and the H-alpha in red. Very strong morphological correspondence between the two phases. The contours here is the neutral hydrogen in the ISM of the galaxy. And so we see that same correspondence in dwarf starbursts, and then we see it also in the Eulers. So here are just three examples of H-alpha images on the left and X-ray images on the right for three of the eight Eulers in our sample. So that's nice. It looks like the same physics is going on across this very wide range in starburst luminosity, star formation power. Now, let's then talk a little bit about trying to get some quantitative numbers out, look at the outflow rates. How do we do this? Well, we have to take a pretty simple-minded approach. So the outflow rates that are derived from X-rays are pretty simple. You basically have an X-ray luminosity and a temperature and a size, and that gives you the mass of X-ray emitting gas modulo the volume filling factor. You measure F times F to the minus 1/2. You measure the pressure times F to the plus 1/2. If you make it clumpy, the pressure goes up. And you measure the total thermal energy content times F to the minus 1/2. So if you were to take the filling factor as being unity just to begin with, then the X-ray size and temperature leads to a sort of characteristic crossing time, and you've got a mass and an energy and a time scale, and that gives you a rough estimate of the mass outflow rate and the energy outflow rate. Now these are, I would only claim, are sort of order of magnitude estimates because we don't know the filling factor well, and the flow speed could be quite a bit higher than the sound speed. This is just assuming a crossing time, assuming Mach 1. But if you do that, then you find that the amount of energy flowing out mapped by the X-rays is comparable to the total amount of energy that's been injected by star supernovae, and you get an outflow rate in mass that's several times the star formation rate, which again is consistent with this idea of this mass loading parameter being of order 10. Now you might say, why can't we have the filling factor be 10 to the minus 4 or some big, very small number that brings down these quantities? But then you run into a problem that you have extremely high pressures. And then you have to ask, how over the halo of a galaxy on scales of tens of kpc would I have these extremely high pressurized X-ray emitting filaments? And so that leads to other problems. If you then say that those high pressures are created by something, then integrating that pressure over the whole volume of the halo drives up the energetic requirements even further. So I don't think going to very small filling factors really helps in terms of the energetics. Now, an independent argument, which goes back to the first papers that I wrote on this subject, comes from the optical emission lines. And here we have the advantage that, unlike in X-rays, we can actually measure the density directly in favorable cases using the stuff that we all learned about when we read Don Osterbrock's book, kind of usually emission line ratios that are density sensitive, and you can therefore measure the density directly, filling factor directly, get the mass directly, and so on. So this filling factor uncertainty drops out. And in particular, you can measure the radial profile of the gas in the halo. So you can measure P of R, and P of R allows you to constrain M dot V in the wind. So M dot V is going to be pressure times the radius times the solid angle subtended by the wind. And this is just what some of these pressure profiles look like. So here's one of the objects that I showed you, a sodium deabsorption line in the wind earlier. This is the pressure in dynes per square centimeter measured directly in this object as a function of radius out to a radius of about 3 kiloparsecs, where the density sensitive diagnostic we use goes into low density limit and you're no longer able to directly measure the density anymore. So you see this highly overpressurized region extending out to large radii and dropping at large radii roughly like 1 over r squared. And we can measure an isobaric radius where the pressure drops to about 10 to the minus 9.5 dynes per square centimeter, and then ask, how does this isobaric radius depend on the energy injection rate from supernovae? So along the x-axis or y-axis here is the energy injection from supernovae and solar luminosities. And this is the radius where the pressure drops to this fiducial value. And you would expect that to go with a slope of 2. And if you have 100% efficiency of supernova thermalization in the wind to produce this ram pressure that you see, then depending on the solid angle, you can predict where the winds ought to lie. And basically, the data points sort of fall along the prediction for a wind flowing into sort of pi steradians, which is roughly consistent with what the pictures look like, so long as the efficiency of thermalization of the supernova energy is of order unity. So you can't afford to have lost lots and lots of energy, or the wind simply wouldn't have enough thrust to produce the pressures that you actually observe. Okay, well, in the last couple of minutes, let me talk about the fate of winds. And since I'm kind of running out of time, maybe I won't show you some of the pictures, but basically, are winds quenched by radiative cooling? Well, we can measure directly the X-ray luminosity, and the X-ray luminosity that we see, I showed you it's 10 to the minus 4 of the bolometric luminosity, so that's about 1% of the energy injection rate from supernovae. Fuse has now looked for oxygen 6 from cooling coronal gas in galactic winds in 3 cases, and in 2 cases they're just upper limits, then there's 1 weak detection, and in all cases the results of that experiment say that cooling from coronal gas is also insignificant dynamically. So how far do winds travel? Well, I think the one lesson you can take away from the pictures that I showed you of the dwarfs and Eulers is that there aren't hard outer boundaries to the X-ray emission. We're simply losing the wind when the combination of adiabatic expansion and cooling causes the surface brightness of the wind to drop below what we can see. And the wind could go quite a bit further out, and in fact, we actually see some examples of that. Here's an example in M82. The grayscale is the H-alpha emission. The contours are ROSAT, soft X-ray emission. In soft X-ray emission and H-alpha, the wind kind of disappears about 6 or 7 kiloparsecs from the center of the galaxy. But then the wind collides with a cloud and lights back up again, and that's what's at the top here. There's both H-alpha emission and a cap of X-ray emission. So the wind is probably adiabatically cooled and dropped below what we can see with an X-ray telescope. When it strikes an obstacle, it lights back up. So the wind has traveled farther than we would have deduced just from the image itself. An even more interesting case, I think, which is maybe slightly more speculative, this is NGC 3079. It's an edge-on starburst galaxy. Here's the optical disk of the galaxy. Here's the Chandra X-ray image showing hot plasma extending about 10 kiloparsecs out of the disk. Until we lose it, the surface brightness drops to very faint levels. What's interesting is it's been known for some time that the companion galaxy, NGC 3073, which is at a projected separation of about 50 kiloparsecs, has this H1 tail for the cometary feature pointing directly away from NGC 3079. Now, this may be somewhat speculative, but if you ask what is the ram pressure in the wind, if it propagates this far, and compare it to the pressure needed to strip the interstellar medium from this galaxy, it would easily suffice to do that. So I think this is, again, indirect evidence that the wind is traveling further than can be seen just by looking at the X-ray emission. Okay, so let me try to conclude. There's just one other point I wanted to make, which I think bears on the point I made earlier about keeping track of phases. What we see when we look at galactic winds is that if we measure the temperature of the hot gas in X-rays, I showed you there are these dwarf starbursts and Ullrichs, they both have the same temperature. So the temperature that you see in the hot phase seems to be completely independent of the potential well of the galaxy it's sitting in. You look at a dwarf galaxy, you look at a major merger, you always see gas at 5 to 10 million degrees. And therefore, one might infer that the hot gas traced in X-rays can selectively escape from low-mass galaxies, but probably not from the massive galaxies, so those are the closed boxes. And that may explain things like the mass-metallicity relation that we heard about earlier in the week. Now, on the other hand, as I think Crystal will probably talk about, when we look at the dynamics of these cool fragments embedded in the wind that we trace with optical emission lines or interstellar absorption lines, there it does look like the velocities of these cold clouds know something about the star formation rate and the mass of the galaxy in which they live. And I would argue that the simplest interpretation is simply that in the very massive, high-powered starbursts, the outflow is saturated. The clouds have been accelerated up to the terminal velocity of the wind and aren't going to go any faster. In dwarf galaxies, low-powered starbursts, the thrust in the wind, the momentum flux in the wind, is just not sufficient to ever bring the clouds up to high velocities. And so if you were to look just at the cool fragments, you might conclude that nothing gets out of any galaxy. When you look at the hot gas, you get a very different picture. So let me just conclude by putting my conclusions up, and I'll be happy to launch into the discussion. Thank you.
Two observational questions. One, has anybody looked for the infrared molecular hydrogen emission in the dusty outflows?
No, that would be an interesting thing to do. At least I don't know of that. I think there are some programs with Spitzer to try to image the dust emission directly, just the thermal emission from the grains, which is a challenging thing because you need tremendous dynamic range. But I don't know of anyone who's...
Something you could do from the ground.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Yeah, I mean, one thing, the one phase that we don't seem to see in the winds is molecular gas.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, because we have a hard time looking right for it through UV.
Right.
One was, in this case where you've got the wind coming out of M82 and cooling before this other cloud, has Charles or you or anybody looked for O6 emission in that region?
It's planned. Okay. We haven't looked yet, yeah.
So you've got that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's pretty faint compared to where we've already looked. So we've looked in the high surface brightness parts of M82 and seen nothing. And this is,
you know the gas
quite a bit fainter, but yeah, right. Right, right. It's sort of a cleaner case in a way.
You showed that the energetics all work out very nicely if you assume that the winds are thermally driven and that the radiative losses initially are small. If the winds were driven by radiation pressure instead, would you say that would then be a coincidence? And because of that, you might say that...
I would say is that I'm completely agnostic about the relative role of radiation pressure and hydrodynamics in accelerating the sort of dusty stuff. I mean, we see dust in the halos, so I'm quite willing to believe that radiation pressure plays a role in accelerating the cool material, but radiation pressure won't give you hot halos of gas at 10 million degrees, so there's clearly more going on. The radiation pressure is probably helping and may, be important in interpreting what you see in the absorption lines and the dusty filaments, but you have to still have some hot wind which is producing the X-ray emission. And the radiation pressure, I don't think, will produce these pressure profiles that you see in the filaments either.
Do you see any change in the temperature of the X-ray emission that would correspond to the adiabatic expansion as you move out in the wind, or is this too difficult to
Yeah, that, but not in a simple way. It's not consistent with the pure adiabatic flow. And I think basically that's because what you're seeing is probably reacceleration of the wind as it interacts with debris. You do see cooling by maybe a factor of two between the central region, which is typically more like 10 million degrees, and then the halo emission, which is typically more like 5 million. But it's not consistent with just a simple picture of adiabatic cooling, because I think you just there's too much probably hydrodynamical interaction going on to see that directly.
Well, Tim, I'm glad to see that your conclusion has shifted a little bit from the one that you had in the past concerning the escape of gas from large galaxies, because I remember all talks that you gave, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, in which you were claiming that also gas can also escape from large galaxies. Now you're saying that the hot gas is there, but still you're saying that, well, maybe the cold one can still escape. But then I would say that if most of the mass and the metals and the dust are in this cold phase, so even it doesn't matter if you lose the hot gas or the cold phase, still you would get in trouble with the metallicity mass relation that you mentioned.
So let me respond. There are a couple of things. I don't know what happens in the massive galaxies, right? This is just a plot of the temperature and the X-rays versus the rotation speed, and so here's the virial temperature. So, I mean, I don't know exactly, you know, how to figure out. This is stuff that's not clearly going to escape in the massive galaxies, but it's close to the escape velocity. Yeah. Let's come back to the question of the budget of where are the metals. There's a comparable mass flux by these rough orders. So these are order of magnitude arguments, but to the extent that you can compare the mass flux you see in the hot gas to what you see in the cold gas, they're comparable. So most of the metals that were produced by the current starburst are in the hot phase, and I would claim that those are the ones that are the most likely to get out of the low mass halos. Right? These are galaxies that have rotation speeds of 30 or 50 kilometers per second, and there's gas at 10 million degrees. So I don't think, at the level of factors of a few, it doesn't really matter for chemical evolution whether the cold gas gets out or not, because it's not the dominant phase containing most of the metals that have been produced in the starburst.
What I try to make is that this temperature, the X temperature, is measured on the scale of 10 kiloparsecs, and you need to get to the virial rays,
sure,
with the same velocity and simply by adiabatic cooling, if nothing else. And
well, adiabatically cool, but energy is conserved. If it adiabatically cools, then it's flowing at 1,000 kilometers per second. Right. Right. I mean, we don't see any radiative cooling, so whether it cools adiabatically or not is irrelevant. If you don't see any radiative cooling outside of a radius of 5 kpc, then it's not losing energy. Now, there's not enough radiation coming in those forms. You can look in O6, you can look at X-rays, and it's what, you know, it's... Well, we've looked, we don't see it. The amount of O6 emission is several orders of magnitude below what you would need to radiatively cool the flow, so... If it's cooling radiatively at large radii, so far we haven't succeeded in seeing it.
I'm puzzled by the sort of if you put gas into an intergalactic potential well at 10 kiloparsecs with an X-ray temperature of several million degrees and a velocity of 500 kilometers a second, it will escape. The radiative loss is apparently negligible. Well, we observe the emission, and I mean, we would observe the emission, and it's not there.
Well, look, I mean, I think the situation for massive galaxies, I would agree we could sort of debate this, you know, ad infinitum. Yeah. I think, in fact, if you want to explain the mass metallicity relation, then pretty much on a cosmic average, the stuff isn't getting out because the mass metallicity relationship is rolling over, and these things probably are closed boxes. So I think that's maybe, you know, nature is doing the bookkeeping, and nature would probably say that most of the metals produced in massive galaxies don't escape into the intergalactic medium. Yeah.
I might have missed this, but did you say why the neutral gas scales with the rotation speed? I didn't.
The neutral
gas velocities, you said, scale with the rotation speeds rather than the...
Well, I think Crystal is probably going to talk about that. This is something you might expect if you had some kind of Eddington limit where radiation pressure was accelerating them.
Oh, so they're not being accelerated, by the
they're
way.
They're not. What seems to be the case is when you look at massive galaxies with high star formation rates, the cold fragments have been accelerated up to the same velocity that you would estimate for the hot gas. So this stuff has been fully accelerated and now it's just flowing out with the hot gas. But when you look at dwarf galaxies, that doesn't seem to be the case. The cold gas is flowing out at much less velocity than you would deduce from the X-ray emission. And you can sort of figure out why that would be the case. It's basically just there's not enough momentum flux. These things are, the winds are not powerful enough for the momentum in the wind to be sufficient to accelerate these high column density clouds up to the velocities that you see in the more powerful objects.
Okay.
Hopefully she'll give a clearer explanation of this then.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank the speaker again.